A new great epoch has begun. There exists a new spirit. There exists a massive work conceived in the new spirit. It is to be met with particularly in industrial production. Architecture is stifled in custom. Style is a unity of principle animating all the work of an epoch, the result of a state of mind. Our own epoch is determining day by day its own style. Our eyes, unhappily, are unable yet to discern it.
So that's Le Corbusier in his great work, the most famous work of architectural theory in the first half of the 20th century, Towards an Architecture, published in English as Towards a New Architecture. And that's going to be the focus of this episode. This is About Buildings and Cities, and I'm George Kinchel.
I'm Luke Jones.
We're looking at the best known of the many books which Le Corbusier produced at a pretty constant rate throughout his life, starting in his mid-20s and going right through to the end of his life. We're looking at the most famous of these, and the one which appears to constitute most clearly a manifesto for his new architectural programme, Vers une architecture, conventionally translated as Towards a New Architecture, is a call to refound architecture in the light of new advances in technology. We're basically just going to go through the book in order. Like, I think basically all of the books that he produces in this period, it originates as a series of related articles in his periodical L'Esprit Nouveau. The two parts which people focus on most are the chapters Eyes Which Do Not See and Architecture and Revolution, but there's actually quite a lot more than that in the book, and we're going to go through the whole thing in order to...
We're developing a dangerous precedent, which we've been developing for a long time, of doing every damn crap thing. We're not going to do all his buildings. And we're not going to do all his books either.
No, not by a long way.
We've already left really undiscussed three books.
Should we do the... At the point that we arrive, he's already written Études sur le mouvement d'art décoratif en Allemagne.
We will say what these things are. Been to Germany, and he was trying to introduce some of the new, great, innovative German industrial design tropes into Switzerland. Then he writes
Après le cubism.
And before Après le cubism, there's France or Germany, which isn't published but is written. And that's him doing the opposite, which is where he's saying, actually, all the stuff I'd said about Germany
being good
is wrong. Everything the Germans have that is good has been copied from the French, and Germans are rotters.
And they have a lot of bad ideas of their own.
They're rotters. And actually, it's because they come from a fundamentally barbaric culture. I haven't read it, but I've only read reviews of it. But
you don't need to read it.
I haven't been able to get hold of it. I haven't even found someone selling it. It seems to be a completely impossible to obtain work. And then there's cubism, which we just it's like après ski, but
après but with cubism. It's discussed in our previous episode.
Then it's modern painting. These books are written with Ozophon. His great friend. This one is the sort of painting one. I haven't been able to get hold of it. We've got one photo of a page in it, which is amazing.
One is forced to try and infer the content of the book from an illustrated spread. And we have on the left page a painting of an a photograph of a statue from ancient Egypt. And on the left, a real-life photograph of a saucy woman wearing some beads and a sort of a loincloth with her breasts exposed. And then on the right, we have a man, an extremely strong, a really beefy...
He's big.
He's very big. He's big. Eating an awful lot of protein. And he's flexing.
His six-pack is ridiculous.
And he has the most extraordinary moustache. And he looks as if he's posing as if he's engaged in bending an iron bar over his thigh.
Yeah, there's a lot of imagery going on there.
Yeah.
And there's a naked woman playing a mandolin...
Yes, in a garden chair.
In a garden chair.
I think the buff man is meant to refer to some kind of piece of monumental, relief sculpture. I can't really read it. No, I can't understand what that is. And then the naked woman in the chair is meant to relate to some sort of painting. There's some sort of comparison going on. I don't really understand it, but I enjoy it very much.
If anyone's got modern painting, when I get hold of it, I think we'll do a little review of it, because it does seem to be quite fun. And if anyone's got it digitally, they can send it to me. at the usual place.
Well, I mean, that's massively derailed the whole episode.
And then there are three books that come out more or less at the same time, which are The Modern Decorative Arts, which we haven't read. And we believe the image we have of that is a picture of some office furniture, which isn't very helpful. But I believe that they, partly influenced by Loos.
Oh, it's quite a spread. So we have a double page spread with some text and some illustration. On the top, there are these big photos of office desks in sort of offices, yeah. Uninhabited. And then at the bottom, there are pictures of shoes. What's the name for that thing that you button down to cover your shoe?
A spat.
A spat.
But not the sort of white spat of the Scots Guard or the sort of spat that was worn by Mies van der Rohe into late life, like the 1970s. But the sort of Czech spat, isn't it?
Yeah.
Looks like it might be made of tweed.
And then there's a sort of a set of illustrations of straw boaters and a pipe with also a case for carrying your pipe in.
But actually, aren't most of these objects in Loos? So in the essay where he's talking about jerseys and how the modern man is going to be dressed in white jerseys and he's going to become this Superman because of it, which also is the one that I keep referring to, which has got the toe cloths. I think that some of those objects are present. Anyway, we are to surmise that a certain sort of modern object, which is functional and has been derived from a process of Darwinian selection, is morally good. Yeah. And decorative arts are in some way connected to the Huns or barbarian invasion or possibly Polynesian cannibals and are bad.
We're gonna get into all of that.
And I'd love to get hold of that book. I haven't tried very hard to get it. We haven't read it.
A bit like a big theme, like he has a particular method which is extraordinary and like audacious use of reference imagery.
Yeah.
Which is just amazing. And we will get into some specific examples of it in Vales une Architecture and all in a further episode where we're just going to talk about Urbanism, his other big book from this period. It's ridiculous. At another level, I mean, it's just wonderful. It's just completely mad.
The format is great picture, insane tendentious statement, then aphorism, or like a bit of poetry.
We've got very short reading. Our engineers are healthy and virile. Active and useful, balanced and happy in their work. Our architects are disillusioned and unemployed, boastful or peevish. So we begin chapter one, the engineer's aesthetic. The thesis of this chapter is that architecture has lost sight of the natural laws, the simplicity, the necessity which governs, for example, engineering, and then it needs to return to them. In the chapter, he describes architectural schools, which significantly he hadn't attended himself, as like hothouses which force chrysanthemums and unclean orchids. One of the real features of this period is that Le Corbusier is obsessed with the idea that engineers possess a kind of clarity of purpose that architects have lost sight of. And that significantly, the chapter begins with this a big, rather beautiful photograph of the bridge that Eiffel had built across one of these big valleys with the train running across the top of it. And it's this image of audacious achievement, infrastructure, deployment of technology. And what he's railing against is an architecture which at that point was like strongly historicist, which placed a strong value on classical orders or the deployment of specific historical styles, this nostalgia for certain monuments in the past or as kind of certain...
It's straight Rorkian. These people are stuck in the past.
Yeah.
It's a copy of a copy of a copy. But there's a key thing about his engineer, which is mentioned quite early on and is easy to miss, which is that his engineer, he says, once the engineer has calculated how, this is an example, how strong the load on a beam, he can choose the ratio of its height and width, and that will be determined by spirit. And that's an example of him saying that the engineer, as he sees it, the great designer, isn't just someone who is choosing things based on their fitness for a purpose, their appropriateness, but also on what follows best in his spirit, in his almost sort of Nietzschean Superman spirit. And he talks a lot about how great the men are you know, how meticulous. Later on, there's an example of an engineer, and he is... Oh, God, it might be in the other book, actually. But I think it's safe to say it's the same sort of thing. These are supermen, and they are not just guided mathematically, but they're also spiritually guided, which is something which is easy to avoid from that argument. But it comes up again and again, this statement.
So what he's yearning for in this chapter is this kind of clarity of purpose, this architecture as a product of happy peoples, which produces happy peoples, this unity with the purposeful and happy society.
It'd be lovely if people listened to the second Bruno Taut episode.
Yeah, because...
Currently, by some margin, our least listened to episode.
Yeah.
Because it will set up a lot of this as a comparison.
Yeah, it's a great piece of audio. Guys.
Yeah. And it's going on just before this.
Yeah.
And it's someone who's slightly madder coming up with similar ideas.
There's this little quotation which opens the chapter. The engineer's aesthetic and architecture, two things that march together and follow one from the other, the one at its full height, the other in an unhappy state of retrogression. Obviously, he's at a moment where actually kind of amazing things have happened during the 19th and early 20th century, you know, the advance of the railways, the invention of the aeroplane, the invention of the motor car, the kind of...
And also great things in architecture, the huge spans of railway stations. Mill buildings had evolved and were now kind of modernist buildings, right? They are concrete-framed infill things with strip windows...
Of enormous size,
regulating daylight, but they are... As he says, they are regarded as products of efficiency and engineering and not really suitable for elegance.
So the claim is that architecture needs to turn to the course which is being plotted by technological evolution. He says, "We claim in the name of the steamship, of the airplane, of the motor car, the right to health, logic, daring, harmony and perfection."
More of that later.
All right, so the second chapter is called Three Reminders to Architects. And... the reminders are mass, surface, and plan.
The way the thing is structured is that there'll be a massive headline and it will say mass, yeah. And above that there'll be a picture. It's laid out with strong graphical sensibility. And if you want to see this, people have put on the internet the French version, which is what you should look at.
Yeah.
In terms of getting the graphics layout.
You know, and here's like an absolutely classic example of the way in which the argument works and the way in which the layout of the page is made. We have mass, the opening, and three reminders to architects. We have a big photograph of a grain elevator. Underneath it says grain elevator in a little small cap text. And then underneath it says, architecture has nothing to do with the various styles. The styles of Louis XIV, XV, XVI or Gothic are to architecture what a feather is on a woman's head. It is sometimes pretty, though not always, and never anything more. So there's this mix of big, strong images and then these absurd, like, aphoristic statements.
Actually, I would say that one isn't too bad. Like, nowadays, we'd kind of agree with that, wouldn't we? The academistic style can be beautiful, but isn't useful for anything. There's the notion of, what are the Freudian terms? When you're interpreting a dream, you've got, like, what's happening in the dream and what it means.
Yeah.
And it's like the manifest and the implicit or something. And what he's talking about with styles is like manifest classicism, which is the literal interpretation of shapes. We're going to stamp acanthus leaves on everything. And I don't think it's a challenge to the sort of implicit underlying classicism, which he's always banging on about in this book. As being a good thing. And I think you've got to see his attack on the classical order as being something which is an attack on the manifest dressings of academism rather than the fundamental orders and regulations.
So when he shows all of these grain elevators, in fact, what he wants us to notice from them is the primary geometry and kind of simplicity of their forms. These are enormous cylinders, often topped by enormous cubes, and they display in their white rendered walls like absolute simplicity.
In the text, he is again and again trying to go back to the primary form, and it's the primary form in historic buildings, in the city, in engineering, and it's the notion that we're going to strip back its dressings, which add nothing. and you're going to be left with something fundamental, he believes is fundamental to architecture, which is that things should be composed of primary forms, the forms he was playing with as a child, those wooden cylinders, cubes, pyramids. At the beginning of this book, he included a printed page from a French primary education chart, which has primary shapes on it. It's in the inside cover of the book. And that's one of the real themes. And that's sort of what he's banging on about maths, except that he illustrates it with a load of photographs of grain elevators.
Yeah, one of the ways that you can talk about this is to say, well, what are the illustrations like in each chapter? This chapter is all pictures of grain elevators. They're all these big cylindrical towers. And he has, you know, about six or seven different grain elevators.
There's a pair of two of them which he'd taken both from a book by Walter Gropius, and he's photoshopped them. With a knife. And he's taken the pediments off to make them exactly the way he wanted it to be.
If this was someone's PhD, you would say that that was a bit much.
Nothing compared to other things he's going to do later.
Right, so surface is a second reminder. And the surface, if we were going to characterise it by what's illustrated, surface is all pictures of factories and of the kind of bay layout, a regular grid of columns and slabs, and then windows of a sort of a set size. So these kind of like rectangular. Essentially, this chapter just talks about the geometry, the kind of regularity. One of the things which is interesting is that he kind of deploys as a thing which people often say, that a building ought to display its structure. And then he says, well, no, that's nonsense. It doesn't need to do that.
And he says students are obsessed with the idea that a building should be true to its structure. But with humans, there are ankles and there are elbows, but what of everything else?
Yeah, which is interesting because this is one of those views which is often imputed to him, but which in fact he was not.
Well, it's because sometimes he says it. The reason lots of things are imputed to him, which you would think he didn't say, is because he says lots of things and then he contradicts himself.
I mean, the other thing which this touches on is something we'll speak to later, which is this idea of proportion, which is actually very important to him. But we'll get to that later. The third reminder is plan. Plan is the generator. Without a plan, you have a lack of order and willfulness. The plan holds in itself the essence of sensation. The great problems of tomorrow, dictated by collective necessities, put the question of plan in a new form. Modern life demands and is waiting for a new kind of plan for both the house and for the city. There are continuities as well as ruptures between his vision of architecture and that which was the sort of predominant teachable view in the past, the sort of Beaux-Arts tradition. So he wants to maintain what was a Beaux-Arts kind of heuristic of design in architecture, which is that plan has primacy. Plan is where buildings can be understood, and plan is also where they can be compared and where they can be typologized and where they can be classified.
Like the way in which people who deal with architecture will relate to this, is plan has got all the stuff people pay for on it. And it tends to be that, like, program is in plan and space is in section. This is sort of very, very crude architectural concept.
No, I think that's a good
and
one.
And so it wasn't mine. I think if you say plan is a generator, it can mean literally that. You start with a program, you start with a brief, and you have to fulfill it, and that's done in plan. And then you synthesize the other properties out of that.
But his critique of the École des Beaux-Arts is that because of certain kind of rules about how, kind of where spaces come from, about precedent, you know, that we're working with sort of circular rooms, square rooms, we're working with kind of hemispherical spaces, or, you know, whatever, we're just sort of taking from history, and that plan has partly become kind of ossified in these fragments, which are being recombined again and again and again in the forms of the buildings. And that partly, and I think this is probably something which is kind of true of architectural university work in the present day as well, but that the plan has itself become aestheticized. The plan has become decorative. He talks about the plan in the Beaux-Arts education as a mosaic upon a decorative panel. And he says, and I, you know, I think this is great. He says, in which the competition is for the most beautiful star pattern, which becomes the Grand Prix de Rome.
And actually, this is a reasonable criticism, I think, because in architecture, plans those beautiful black and white stark graphics have a really stunning graphical quality. And you can go down the kind of Piranesi route until you get to the... People should check out the Piranesi plan, reconstruction of the field of Mars. And you get these things which are stunning graphical sentiments. But it's not architecture.
No, it's a kind of a pattern. And this is one of the approaches to design which was commonly taught was this thing called pushy, which is like the idea that you colour in architectural mass in black and you leave everything else in white. And you sort of think in very abstract, simplified terms about the organisation of the building in terms of the sort of figure ground arrangement of the black on the white on the page.
And actually, it's I would say, well, certainly in the classical tradition that I was taught here, I don't know about the French, Pochet is a kind of hierarchical notion where it literally means the black bits that are coloured in, but it also is the notion that you start with your primary most important things, you know, whatever the big key rooms are, and then there's a secondary order of how you get around them and the secondary space, and then there's the service. So you generate the plan hierarchically. So you start with the really key spaces and their relationship, and then the things that serve them, and then the tertiary service, and then the black void. And the poche is the notion of the lower points on the hierarchy, which kind of come the infill.
Yeah, exactly. So you sort of lay out the big spaces, and initially the big spaces have big black areas between them, and then you fit the other things which the building has to accommodate into those black areas. There are multiple levels of the metaphor. They become kind of pockets within the pockets. So maybe we can talk about... He wants to take the idea of the primacy of the plan. He still thinks that one should organise a building around its plan, but he has this critique of the Beaux-Arts approach, which we think is a fair one. There are some other points. He says that a building is like a soap bubble, by which he means that it's sort of pushed outward by the force of whatever's going to be in it. The interior generates an exterior. And, we're now flashing forward to the last chapter, but whatever, or the penultimate chapter. And actually, this section of the book is illustrated with these rather nice plans, which are all, I think, plan sketches of buildings he'd visited on his travels in 1911. So they're little sketches of the Green Mosque and of the, you know, little fragments of the Villa of Hadrian and...
I've got two thoughts while you're talking. The first one is these books draw from everything he knew, which we've kind of said everything he knew. It's the books he's read and the places he's been, and it's everything from those places are marshalled for his thesis, and it's crammed together. And the second thing is, if it seems like we're spending a lot longer talking about plan than we are about mass, it's because he's much more interested in plan than mass, or rather his idea about mass is... He doesn't actually have a thesis of mass. His thesis of mass is primary shapes are good.
The other thing about plan is that plan is what society desperately needs. We need a plan. We need a plan for the city. We need a plan for architecture. And so the plan also refers to this great agenda which he has for a new model of urbanism, a kind of a renewal, a material renewal of the city and of the organisation of society. So the next chapter, there's a little bit on regulating lines. What this means is proportion. This is an essay about proportion. And it's...
Although I would say it's a little bit more about lines because it's proportion, but always represented with certain sorts of lines.
Diagonals. I've got a little quote. An inevitable element of architecture, the necessity for order. The regulating line is a guarantee against willfulness. It brings satisfaction to the understanding. The regulating line is a means to an end. It is not a recipe. Its choice and the modalities of expression given to it are an integral part of architectural creation.
The structure of the essay is there are a number of pictures of historic monuments, particular sorts of historic monuments, and also buildings by him. These are the two categories, like the great monuments of time, and his rather limited oeuvre.
Yeah, carry on. There's some good stuff to talk about here.
And on them, he has drawn lines demonstrating proportions, sometimes reasonable and sometimes tendentious.
Yeah, specifically the golden section.
But also squares.
Yeah.
And also that something is as wide as something else is high. There's some, a lot of them seem like they're golden section, except they're not actually golden section, are they?
No.
They're a different, they're just rectangles.
One of Le Corbusier's, one of his absolutely classic modes of argument is to start from the beginning of human history.
Mm.
And you know,
what's great about the distant past? We don't know anything about it, so you can make up whatever you want.
In Urbanism, which we're going to talk about later, he begins with this image of the like primitive man rolling in his chariot, and he like comes to a stop and cuts down some trees
and like, makes a hut.
Makes a hut and makes like a square around it.
And then like... the pictures accompanying this are chariot, primitive mallet.
So in the chapter Regulating Lines, the opening images are a primitive temple, which is a drawing of something which he's made up himself.
It's completely made up. It's a tent surrounded by a tent. It's like one of those... This is a real piece of English cultural idea. You know the windbreak you hammer into the beach?
Yeah.
It's a tent surrounded by a windbreak.
Yeah.
But it's got lots of regulating proportions. It's composed of two squares, right angles, and all sorts of things. He's labelled up a diagram with letters.
So... at this point in his career, certainly, he believes unequivocally in the sort of magic of the golden section. He talks about how children, imbeciles...
Yeah, he says...
He says
children, savages and old men
will naturally
draw golden sections.
Actually, I used to work for someone who... their kind of thing for... which was very effective. Their thing for doing planning... You know, when you're doing planning and you want to justify why the elevation looks a certain way.
Planning is in building control rather than...
Yeah, as in development control. Yeah. You just draw a golden section across sort of various bits of the windows or, you know...
It's not a golden section, it's just a diagonal line.
It's just a diagonal line, yeah. But if it 100% works, you know, you sail through pre-planning because it looks like... you're doing something wonderfully harmonious and also in touch with, you know, the deepest reaches of human unconsciousness.
The psyche, the cosmos. And the trick is, yeah, any rectangle, you can draw a diagonal line across it.
No one is measuring them. No one's checking that it's like 1.61.
Which doesn't even, like, it doesn't have to be a golden section. Most of Corb's ones aren't golden sections. They're just rectangles. I mean, usually he's demonstrating that he's used the same rectangle in two places in the elevation.
One of the articles in L'Esprit Nouveau, which actually doesn't make it into any of the books, is an article which he got someone else to write about the Villa Schwab, which is illustrated by these pictures of the elevations showing the regulating lines in the elevation. I put them on the Instagram, I think.
They do show that certain things relate to each other and certain things have set proportions. They're like there are squares, double squares... I'm not even sure if there is a golden section, and that the same rectangle will be used, you know, vertically and horizontally and things. But it's, and actually doing that sort of thing, it's something I've certainly done, but it's something you can do to anything because all you're doing is knocking things very slightly in and out. And it does kind of have a psychological effect that it can make things look slightly starker. Although sometimes I wonder if it's just because it's forcing you to do slightly strange things. And that, like, stark strangeness is quite nice as well.
So one of the things which I think is weird about this, because he does talk about the golden section, and he does offer it as this sort of divine geometry, is it's something which unites him with his much later kind of iconoclasts. If you think of people, the sort of traditional architecture crew, sort of Christopher Alexander and his inheritors, these are people who also espouse... the magic of mathematics. I think at some point it would be good to do a reading on a pattern language and things, which actually, as an aside, I think is more read by architecture students nowadays than is vers une architecture, which I think is kind of...
Oh, sure it is, yeah. Because vers une architecture is hackneyed now.
Yeah. I mean, in a sentence, my critique of all those guys is that they start off talking about science... and, like, within a few lines are essentially doing the Ten Commandments.
It's just, this is, if you're ever... You're someone who likes radicalism.
Yeah.
One of the best tools of radicalism is pretending that you're being more conservative. You're bringing about change by appealing to a greater past. And there is no greater past than the cosmic, mythic, before time. You know, if you really want to upturn society completely, you say we're going back to the Zhou dynasty, or we're going back to the proto-Indo-Europeans or the Etruscans or something.
Neo-Etruscan.
We're going to be Neo-Etruscan. And what we're really into is these like cosmic harmonies. And the cosmic harmonies are very appealing, but this is a trope that is true of sort of like extreme out with the old policy in general throughout human history, is the appeal to the extreme past.
If you have similar taste to me, I really recommend picking up some of the books of Rob Krier, the sort of lesser known elder brother of Leon Krier, who has these crazy books of architectural design where he does he just picks random works of art, including sort of weird fragments of things that he's bought, and is like, ah, there's the golden section. There's the golden section. And then he does one where he's like, I measured myself, my wife, and my 13-year-old daughter, and here are all their measurements tabulated. As you can see, golden section. It's so mad. It's amazing.
You can make any rectangle into anything.
Yeah.
Because you can compare the bottom right corner of this window to the
cornice
of this thing here. And then that's like 1.5 golden sections if you move it 3 mil to the left.
There are lots of really good rectangles. I'm a big fan. So Edwin Lutyens, who's a sort of semi-contemporary of Corbusier, maybe a tiny bit older.
He reviews this book. There's a famous review of this book in The Telegraph. I have read it, but not recently.
Is a big fan of the slightly squatter rectangle. It's essentially the ratio of the base to the diagonal of a square. So it's like slightly, it's squished. It's short. It's a stubbier rectangle. He uses it in a lot of elevations in the kind of window mullions and things. It looks really beautiful. I mean, he's a fantastic designer.
It's quite near 5'4". It's a little bit longer than 5'4", really which nice. Is a really... 5'4"'s really nice. Are nice. Those, like, quite thick rectangles are nice. And double square is an interesting one as well.
Yeah, that's a nice one as well. There are loads. The golden... Like, you hear an awful lot about golden section from people who know, like, one thing about geometry.
But all of these things, they're just rectangles.
Yeah. It's one of...
Some are nicer.
Right, we're on to the most famous chapter of all. We are on to eyes which do not see.
And what do the eyes not see? Because in fact, it says at the beginning of each section, eyes that do not see the aeroplanes. Eyes that do not see.
It's the most coherent chapter, and it starts with this provocation, which is that he says something which he doesn't believe at all, but which he then sort of frames in a way so that it means what he means it to. So he says, in fact, the decorative arts of this era are in fine health. The decorative arts of this era are producing wonderful things. But in fact, what he means by the decorative arts of the era are liners, airplanes, and cars. He has this quote about the architectural decoration of the era, which is as follows. Tailpieces and garlands, exquisite ovals, where triangular doves preen themselves or one another. Boudoirs, embellished with poofs in gold or black velvet, are now no more than intolerable witnesses to a dead spirit. These sanctuaries stifling with elegancies, or on the other hand, with the follies of peasant art, are an offence. We have acquired a taste for fresh air and clear daylight.
Like the lessons to architects, this is divided into three, and the lessons are liners, airplanes, motorcars.
The cover of the book, there's a picture of a gallery deck of a liner.
So the lesson of the liners is that, in fact, the decorative arts are at a new height, but people can't see it because they're looking at the wrong things. And they're stifled by custom. They do not see that the liner presents a model of a building as a machine for living in. So he has this thing which we actually heard at the start of the programme. Our epoch is fixing its style day by day. In other words, in the liner, we see coalescing a new architect.
And in fact, I think that idea partly had come from Pelle, who was trying to create the order reinforced concrete. Yeah. Not as an architectural style, but as an order of its age. And he'd been thinking about this for a while. And I think Jeanneret expands this to everything. What is the order of the machine age?
The machine for living in, as a phrase, is one of the great provocations of architectural history, really.
The examples that he gives are machines for living in. It's a saloon car, which is done up like a sort of living room. yeah. and an ocean liner, where people do live for a week or so.
Yeah.
And it's sort of all the mod cons, right? But it's inside a machine.
As we go on to aeroplanes, in fact, aeroplanes is where he fleshes out this thesis of the building as a machine for living in, because he's thinking about the aeroplane as this precisely engineered, precisely and very rapidly developingly engineered solution to
a
problem.
In fact, and this is something he's been talking about, he talks about these things in Darwinian terms.
Because it's undergone this incredibly rapid transformation.
Yeah. And as he says, because of the war. And he is always talking about selection. And he doesn't talk about fitness, but it's what he means. He means that these engineering products, ocean liners, cars and aeroplanes, are engineered, evolved things. There's a selective pressure, and the shape that they have is because of an evolutionary process that is not tending towards taste, but is tending towards necessity.
He says there has been no salutary war, as in the case of the aeroplane. You know, architecture needs to undergo this kind of scourging.
But then he will have the engineer, again, guided by spirit.
Yeah.
So this is
it's just someone screaming outside the house.
It's actually a very nice neighbourhood, right? That thing is something which I think runs right through his work, the idea that he's always interested in the engineered, evolved perfection, but it's always geistig.
Yeah.
It's always also spiritually infused somehow.
Actually, the photos of the aeroplanes in this chapter are, many of them are the inside, they're like the interior cabins. We see the seats which people sit on. We see these kind of upholstered leather seating inside the
also the formed bodywork, which has got kind of organic, you know, it's the streamlining like that of a whale or a body.
One of the odd, so the house of a machine for living is meant to be, it's meant to be this wonderfully comfortable, commodious place with all modern conveniences.
Yeah.
One of the things which he says again and again is people don't spend any time at home because their homes are so terrible. They go out to nightclubs. The ladies go out for tea. They would stay at home if they had a better home.
It kind of happened, right? You know, now we've all got our massive tellies and the internet. Who goes outdoors anymore? All your desires can be satisfied.
In this part, he makes a call for people to demand certain things of their architecture, rather than accepting conventions or accepting fashions. He has this section on what he calls the manual of the dwelling. Demand a bathroom looking south, one of the largest rooms in the house or flat. The old drawing room, for instance. One wall to be entirely glazed, opening, if possible, to a balcony for sun baths, the most up-to-date fittings, with a shower bath and gymnastic appliances.
This has never gone away in architecture. I personally have been in charge of the demolition of two student architect-designed extensions, both of which had outdoor showers for sun showering, which was very à la mode.
Yeah.
And we smashed them. We smashed
them down.
It doesn't
work very well in Britain.
No, one was in Cambridge, of all places. Like, it's, I mean, but the poetic attraction is there. And I guess it was quite cool in the 70s.
It's all a bit like, you know, Irvin Welsh's Choose the Future, Choose Life.
Choose life. Choose a job. Choose a career. Choose a family. Choose a fucking big television. Choose washing machines, cars, compact displays and electrical tin openers.
You know, demand concealed or diffused lighting. Demand a vacuum cleaner.
Demand 100% glazed bathroom.
Demand a separate garage to your dwelling. Demand that the maid's room should not be an attic. Do not park your servants under the roof. Demand ventilating panes to the windows in every room.
It's a good bit in another one where he's like, no one would put the maid's staircase in their living room, regardless of how attractive their maid is.
Oh, he is a massive pervert, yeah. What are the demands? Essentially, the demand is all mod cons. The demand is concealed storage. The demand, in many
it's
ways...
It's stuff he tried to put in his parents' house. Yeah. You know, gas and electric lighting in every room. All Yale locks and fitted wardrobes and... He's really into infrastructure. This is a theme of these books in general. It's like more... If you can think of another piece of infrastructure, if you can think of another sort of mod con, all of them and more.
It's why I come back to this kind of Marie Kondo-like decluttering thing. A big theme in it is putting everything away.
Everything should have a slotted drawer, including your children. You should know all your possessions, and each of them should have a carved slotted drawer for it to go in, which probably has got one of those, you know, the thing where you touch it and it pops out slightly that you get in irritating kitchen fittings.
The Automobiles chapter is not that important in terms of the content, but it contains the most famous, graphically most famous spread, which is this one, on which on the left page we have the Temple of Paestum, on the right we have the Parthenon, and below we have the Humber automobile and the Delage Grand Sport, which is, so, you know, temples, automobiles are coming together.
But it's also, it's not any old automobiles and any old temples. It's very important that it's precision cut Doric temples and sports cars. The racing car in particular is important that they're racing cars because their performance, the engineering is all, you know, it's aerodynamic. Every piece is tuned up for optimal speed. And the interesting thing is he regards the Parthenon, as being just like that.
Yeah.
It's Doric, geometric, the stone is cut, there's no leaves all over it. Luckily, an Englishman had come 100 and something years before and taken all the sculpture off it, and so there's not too much decoration. It's really precise, and he regards that as something which has been a product of selection.
So we're looking at two temples which are separated by about 200 years, but which nevertheless conform to a kind of unified style. They're essentially doing the same thing. The Parthenon is obviously much more refined. The Temple of Paestum has these rather these lovely columns which bow out slightly in this slightly.
Well, they bow out. I mean, the ones in the Parthenon bow out some. The ones in Paestum bow out quite a lot, particularly at the top.
Yeah.
The Parthenon, you can make this argument that it's about which was made in late antiquity, that it's made to compensate for the perspective in your eyes.
Yeah.
So you're at the bottom, it's got a kind of false perspective, they taper in slightly, and also that the building as a whole tape, you know, is that the corners of the plinth are slightly lower than the middle, and this makes it feel straighter and bigger.
I think on the kind of semantic level and also on a graphic level, this is just like a wonderful piece of iconoclasm.
There's two things. It's an amazing provocation, but it also is making a point, which is, it's again, it's claiming that I am dealing with something, this isn't just modern, this is universal.
The way he phrases it, he talks about a standard. We're trying to make a standard in architecture. We need a new standard for our new age. And the Greek temple is a standard. They were building them like this for centuries.
What he loved again and again in the Greek temples is the Doric column and the Doric capital, because it's this really perfectly cut shape, and it's a complicated shape. It's these flutes coming to the sort of rounded base of the dome, and there might be and you have to cut it very finely. And they put huge, like, in the accounts of building these temples, fluting a column is like 20 people for a month.
We have these wonderful pairings of images. We've got the Parthenon, we have this close-up of the entablature and the, you know, what's resting on there, and then we have the cockpit of the triple hydroplane Caproni.
Yeah, yeah.
I have no idea
what
this is. It's like insane thing with all these buttons. What do the buttons do?
Oh, it's a huge plane, though. It's a huge plane. It's got loads of engines, is the answer. Next section.
So we have a section called The Lesson of Rome, which I think we talked about already, but essentially...
We haven't really talked about it.
Condensed. Ancient Rome was a mix of good and bad. The good things were that they built... I think, for Corbusier, a lot of the good things about Rome had been revealed by the depredations of history. So, you know, the baths of Diocletian, you experience these extraordinary soaring masses of brickwork, which, over a period of several hundreds of years, people built enormous pits within and systematically knocked all the marble lining off and burnt it to make lime, thus revealing this wonderful primary geometry. You know, they stacked up the statues of all of the emperors and the Vestal Virgins and everything and burnt them into powder.
Make mortar for their rugged hovels. Which is exactly what was happening to... This is what caused the pinching of the... The legitimate relocation of the Elgin Marbles. Although, actually, I would defend him a little bit with Rome. I think there is, in Roman architecture, a genuine sensibility towards primary form. Sure, the Pantheon would have been much more decorated in its day, although actually without some of the like twiddly stuff that was put on in the Renaissance. But it's still a sphere inside a circular cylinder. And I think there is more primary geometry in Roman architecture than there is in Renaissance architecture. I mean, Brunelleschi's well into it, but lots of people aren't. If you think even like Strange Things, they're into cylinders. Cylinders are not a shape, which is...
This chapter, like many in the book, is very much a sort of travelogue. So he does ancient Rome. He visited some ruins of ancient Rome.
And he's taken... And this is a classic thing. He's got a map of ancient Rome, which is a highly... it's an early reconstruction of ancient Rome. And then he's traced over it the shapes he likes, just to reveal them. So that he's just like from an abstraction, he's extracted his things.
But then he, like, segues to Michelangelo.
No, there's the Byzantines
between. Yeah, there is a little bit. I can't even remember what he says about them.
He says the Byzantines are like Greeks, but they're a bit mucked up. And then he's got this picture of this church, which is a humble church for the people, made of this massive pile of marble. And then he's got the most photoshopped image, where he's almost reconstructed the entire background of this altar, taking out like the column, drawing in a whole new, to make it all modernist. And he's saying that, you know, that there are splutterings of culture in the darkest hours.
I'm not sure. I mean, the Byzantines did iconoclasm, but honestly, I'm not sure they ever really did, like, Puritan aesthetics. Did they ever go through a period where they didn't like gold?
No.
No.
No, they're all about gold.
Yeah. And then we reach Michelangelo. So we've done the three, like, key eras of Rome.
Yeah, the Byzantine era of Rome.
It's essentially the era
minor.
It's essentially the era of destroying Rome, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I can't...
Knocking down all the aqueducts and, like, generally...
I can't think of any other buildings from Byzantine Rome.
I mean, the Byzantine era of Rome is turning it into a, like, malaria-infested swamp. And then leaving.
Like wolves in the plain of Mars. Yeah. There were 40 families living in Rome.
But Michelangelo, so he loves Michelangelo, and he loves... But essentially, he has like a long critique of why they fucked up by St. Peter's by adding the nave and the big square of Bernini. And he has this imaginative reconstruction of what it should have looked like if they built it according to Michelangelo's original design. If you want to know more about all of that, we have quite a lot of episodes about Michelangelo, which you can listen to. I don't mind Bernini's square. It's definitely the best thing Bernini ever did.
Yes, but Bernini's on the dark side.
Actually, I think the great sin against St. Peter's was what Mussolini did, which was to open this new triumphal axis leading all the way down to it. And I think one of the great things about the way in which it originally worked was that you emerged out of these sort of quite dark streets suddenly into this extraordinary elliptical piazza in front of it. Yeah. And that you kind of came, you didn't see it from
far away. That's the great sin of the exterior. There's some sins in the inside. Anyway, he's got a man crush like we all do on Michelangelo and how great his geometry. He has got a lot about his geometry and the toughness of his materials and the beauty of the stone.
We have the illusion of plans.
This is the next section after Rome.
I don't think there's all that much to say about this, to be honest. I think we've said it. He has the pure creation of the mind, which is about the... And in a way, I think this sort of rolls back some of his earlier comments kind of about the valorization of engineering, which are to say that architecture is still fundamentally necessary. The spirit is necessary. And I have a quotation.
Well, it's the thing that we were talking about.
Yeah.
Like, but I think it's that he... Yeah, you do your quotation.
You employ stone, wood and concrete. And with these materials, you build houses and palaces. That is construction. Ingenuity is at work. But suddenly, you touch my heart. You do me good. I am happy, and I say, this is beautiful. That is architecture. Art enters in.
He's someone who thinks a lot about aesthetics, and he's been painting a lot, and he's been thinking about what makes this thing beautiful.
Yeah.
And the beauty of it is not something which he can wholly kind of subsume within the logic of engineering or within a kind of quasi-Darwinian like efficiency.
He's making an argument which has been made many times by architects, which I think is bogus, which is that, and in fact it's like one of the great bogus books of our time, The Autopoiesis of Architecture, is essentially this, is that if you input the site and its conditions, by a process of logical deduction and calculation, the perfect building will arise. And he sort of is toying with this notion, which is to do with fitness and selection, but he can't ever really commit to it because it needs spirit. And
he believes in beauty. Mm. He believes in it. And ultimately he wants to row back and kind of claim.
I think he has an oceanic feeling. I mean, he's not really saying it here, but I think he has, you know, that emotional...
I mean, he's a weird guy. He's a hard person to sympathise with. He doesn't treat people all that well all the time. But he has things which he loves. He loves the sun. He believes in beauty. He cares about humanity in a way which is very abstract, but which is not, like, entirely divorced from the reality.
But the thing is, it can go both ways. He has the oceanic feeling of love towards everybody and wanting everybody to be good. He also is happy to say, I love cities because they're the place where the weak are crushed and the strong are, like, rise, you know.
So we have a chapter about mass production houses. I don't think we have to go into it because it's essentially the Maison Domino again.
We can talk about it in the next book.
And then we reach the final chapter. And this is one of... This, I think, is the other really, like, salient and focused on part of the book. Is a chapter called Architecture or Revolution. The thesis here is that society has changed. People see all around them the way in which the world has changed, and they are no longer going to be prepared to accept these kind of unsatisfactory conditions in which they're placed.
And also that, like, changes in modern life have sent us in a careering along a trajectory to destruction.
But people are exposed to new technology. They're exposed to, like, the newness. They're exposed to the kind of... And then they go home to their terrible homes, which are full of, like, swags and curtains and horrible cushions.
But also just cold and they're cold miserable and damp. And they don't have internal plumbing.
This is the thesis of the chapter, Architecture or Revolution. Either a modern society will deliver a good life for everyone. Mental, physical health, diversion, entertainment, happiness... As more than just like an opportunity, but as a thing that one is surrounded by, or they're going to burn it down.
There's got to be a wholesale reinvention of the built environment. And really, I think he'd been thinking, and it was in the air that the old order was going to crash down. And he writes a letter, one of the Ritter letters. He says, you know, the whole thing is going to be burnt down. He wrote a letter about the coming revolution, I think, in the early stages of the war, before the Bolshevik one. And I think people were talking about revolution. Yeah. It wasn't as if the communist revolution in Russia was the first attempted revolution. The 19th century has seen wave after wave of suppressed revolutions. And some successful ones. There had been successful revolutions as well. It's just that they managed to be diverted in various directions.
I think this kind of encapsulates the ambiguity of the position of the architect, which is that on one hand... One aspires to bring in the kind of the new place where people are going to live out their lives. In another sense, one is like the tool of capital. There are certain people who pay for buildings, and you build the buildings that they want you to build.
I think at this stage, Le Corbusier is definitely identifying himself as a capitalist.
Yeah, absolutely. And
not as a believer in capitalism, as a participant.
So the chapter is an appeal to the capitalist, because that's the only person to whom the appeal makes sense. It's saying to the member of the elite, you have a chance to forestall the dawning of a socialist age, which is going to dispossess you, which is going to expropriate your wealth, which is going to send you to the guillotine. In that sense, it kind of identifies Corbusier with this sort of reformist tendency.
It's funny, though, because, I mean, I'm not sure I really... Because he's talking his book... I think his reform instinct is driven by him talking his book and his architectural interest. Yeah, he slightly prefers totalitarianism.
Well, he just wants to get things done, doesn't he?
That's it, because it's sort of preferable. And it can be... And at times in his life, he prefers, like, totalitarian capital control.
Yeah.
As in, you know, the free market capitalist is going to control everything. Fascism... Or communism.
He goes all over the place.
And yeah. he essentially what he likes is to be in a court, talking to the supreme leader, he's always trying to persuade this class of person, and never actually succeeds. And always his success comes through other means, but he never seems to quite cotton on to that. There's a natural thing, which is that avant-gardes, if you're going to get anything done, you always have to work with the powers that be. And that means not that... It means that there's a sorting mechanism with things that are useful to the powers that be getting carried forth.
Yeah.
This is why, not so very long ago, there were lots of sort of consultation practices in London. And they always seemed to... They had a few sort of nice projects with the state or with charities, and another bit was that they would work with big developers and end up being complicit in selling crappy developments. We've got this patch of... small patch of scrub in the front. Would you like this to be this sort of, like, empowering community expression, or this sort of... All the while...
Yeah. They're like wheels.
Everything else is done. I mean, the reason I was hesitating is because, like, we all know people who've been involved in it in one level or another, and I'm sure they would mount a strong defence of this movement, and quite rightly so, and that the people are very much serious about their engagement. But the other thing I wanted to say about the section is the images again. And here the images are, again, diverse. There are two really famous ones. There's the Fiat factory. Yeah. This amazing manifesto of a building for kind of futurism and modernity in Turin, which is this auto factory with a racetrack on the roof. And this kind of integration. And it's presented as if it's almost at sea, you know, in this tabula rasa sort of surroundings. And then the last image is something which we haven't talked about a lot. He puts a pipe in as a sort of modernist object. Doesn't sort of say anything. But going through it, there are statements that disrupt what he's saying. And he has kind of... there is a little bit of something which I haven't heard people remark on. There's a little bit in this of Ulysses, or of the Surrealist Manifesto of this time, yeah. In that there's bits of... It's much truer in the second book, and we'll expand on it more there, but there are bits of sort of the counter-thought bubbling up between the pages, you know, the little aphorisms and things. But I think that's more true in the other work, so we can... But I think the pipe is a kind of... As well as being a... I mean, he smoked like a chimney, and he was smoking a pipe at this point, and... They're in the paintings again and again, and it's an industrial object, but I also think it's a surrealist object.
Well, if I can remember what I was going to say, the thing I want to do is to make a case for this chapter. I think that there is a standard reading of this chapter, which is of this craven bargain with capital. It's this, you know, it's this moment of selling out. It's this moment of admitting the kind of power, the powerless of the architectural avant-garde to advance sort of social progress. I think that there is like a genuine, that in the demands, there is something genuinely valuable, which is that when we talk about, you know, what should the city provide? What should we demand? What should our right to the city be? These are demands which are typically articulated by anarchists. And they are typically articulated in this way where what they sort of imagine is, you know, the right to the city should be the right to like squat a bunch of stuff. And to, yeah, like, set up, like, a bunch of nebulously defined sort of social centres.
There's a nice thing, which is that people demand the right to be like them, but slightly better off, right? So if you're an anarchist, you demand the right to anarchist freedom, liberty, the transgression of rules. And if you are an aspirant bourgeois, you demand the right to effective transport, good communications, excellent housing, complete with mod cons, comfortable living, and there's a lot to be said for those things.
But I think this should be read as a demand for full luxury communism.
Well, there's a way in which it's not communism, which is that it allows space for social differentiation.
Yeah, well, we'll kind of come on to that in urbanism, because I think that this chapter is not really clear. What's being demanded is rather the fruits of what is possible with technology. And what's demanded is a city which does not merely, like, leave one free to seek certain things, but rather, you know, pours the benefits of civilization into one's already open mouth.
Not long after this, people should listen to the Jean Renaudie episode,
yeah,
before the Renaudie buildings in Ivry, we looked at the buildings built in the early 30s and late 20s, which were slab block council houses, hot water and electricity for everyone. And that was built by the communists.
Those were luxuries. That was luxury for everyone.
Absolutely. Yeah, everyone gets hot and cold running water in the 20s.
Yeah.
And, you know, modern conveniences. And this should be something which everybody, like the industrial labourer who's producing this stuff, should have the benefit of his production. And I think it's a time when perhaps, like, we know what communism was, but at this time, the model hasn't really been, is being proposed, but has, like, it is open to question. And I think that's, yeah.
What is an infrastructure which supports not only what is useful, but also what is delightful? These things are also what needs to be provided. And that, I think, is the utopian kind of potential of this chapter, which I think is widely neglected.
He has great like this stuff. Sure, it was coming. He wasn't the first person to invent a lot of this, but he's at least as good as William Gibson at imagining the future, which is already here.
Yes, absolutely.
In the early 1920s, this was not the world. He could see a degree of the potential of the mechanical machine age, and a lot of the things he says, like Maison Domino, is an amazing piece of futurology. Even if it's a crap piece of capitalism.
We should leave it there. Thank you very much for listening. And we'll be back with you very soon.
Goodbye!
Yeah. Au revoir.
I'm going to get some sherry because I don't want red wine.
Okay. Me voilà mal à manger, j'ai bouton sur le bout du nez. Quand je viens pour regarder, je vous dis que ça me fait loucher. Je vous assure, c'est bien souffrant, ça me fait du mauvais sang. Je me suis fait une bonne onga, la guérite n'a pas grand temps. Puis j'en ai haï sur le bout de la langue qui ne m'empêche de turluter. Puis ça me fait bégayer, bégayer, bégayer. J'ai un clou sur le nerf du cou qui est aussi grand que 30 sous. J'en ai un sur le menton qui est aussi gros qu'un citron. J'en ai un autre sur le bas de l'oreille qui me sert de pendant d'oreille. Je vous assure qu'il tarnisse pas son garantie 14 garants. Puis j'en ai un sur le bout de la langue qui m'empêche de turluter. Ça me fait bégayer, bégayer, bégayer. J'ai de la misère à marcher, je ne module en saut du pied. Quand je mets mes...